Hello.
My name is Isaac Brickman, and welcome to Office Hours. Each episode, I will talk to a professor about a topic that is relevant to you. On each show, the guest will have a different perspective on the topic. The goal is twofold. First, I want to make academia more accessible, applicable, and exciting to everyone, including non-academic audiences. I also want to help dissolve the boundaries between disciplines by taking a more holistic approach to learning. I am thrilled to welcome Irvin Jamil Sheikh to our third episode of Office Hours and first episode on religion, a timelessly controversial topic. Irvin is a historian who has taught at Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Istanbul Shahir University. He has also held guest positions at Boston University, Sabancı University, Boğaziçi University, and the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where, fun fact, I had an exciting class with him last semester and had the privilege of writing a paper about authoritarianism and technology in Turkey. His current research interests are focused on cultural and intellectual history, the arts of the book, gender and sexuality, and human-animal relations, all in the context of Islam and particularly Turkey. He is the author, editor, or co-editor of 11 books, as well as numerous articles. Welcome to the show, Irvin.
Hello.
You are a historian. Why is being a student of history important?
Well, for one thing, there's an old cliche, right, that I'm sure you've heard before, which says that, history repeats itself. Well, that's certainly not always true, but sometimes it is, and at least to some degree. And so we can learn a great deal about the present and the near future by looking at the past and making sure that we don't make the same mistakes that others have made before. To give you a simple example, right? During the Second World War, the German attempt to conquer Russia repeated many of the mistakes made by Napoleon about 130 years earlier. It isn't that the conditions were identical, but some were. And certainly the Germans could have spared themselves tremendous losses if they had bothered to learn something from history. And the same applies to, Russia's experiences in Afghanistan and America's experiences in Vietnam and any number of other conflicts. So, people have a way of repeating past mistakes because they refuse to learn from history. But to my mind, there's another important thing that history teaches us, which is almost like the opposite of what I was just saying, which is that the world was not always the way it is now. And that means that many of the things that we take for granted, that we take as, immutable truths today and do not question, are not so immutable after all. Take sexuality, for example. People look at the world today and compare it with 20, 30, 50 years ago, and then they extrapolate backward from there. So issues like LGBTQ rights, for example, are seen as something modern and never before seen. And conservatives do this a lot. They interpret things like sexual liberation and gay rights as an indication that somehow society has lost its bearing, that things were the way they should be and now they're not. But in fact, if we look at history, we see that there were times and places where sexual freedoms, including freedom of sexual orientation, were much, much broader than they are today, like Europe in the 18th century, for example. So what does that mean? Well, it means that history can be a revolutionary tool for the simple reason that it tells us things were not always the way they are, and therefore they need not continue to be the way they are. History tells us, in other words, that a different world is possible. And this is something quite radical, if you think about it. When people pontificate about, human nature, for example, in quotes, that it is this way or that way, well, history gives us the tools to argue that there is no such thing as an unchanging human nature, and therefore that trying to build a better world is not an exercise in futility. And to me, this is the most important benefit of studying history.
That's really interesting. Kind of make me think that the importance of history are how people in charge use history, really, in a way.
Very true.
I wanna talk about religion, and then we can connect it back to history. What is your definition of religion, and why is it so difficult to define?
Well, actually, I'm not sure that religion is difficult to define per se. What is difficult is finding stable criteria by which to distinguish religion from its two immediate neighbors. What are they? On one side, you have science, and on the other side, you have magic. And since the 19th century, people have tried to do this, to distinguish religion from science and from magic, and they've failed miserably. You know, names like from Tyler to Fraser, through Durkheim and Moss to Malinowski and Tambia. Now, some may object and offer their own criteria. Like you might say, well, science is empirically verifiable and repeatable. Magic is practical and does not require a divinity, and things like that. And people have done this before. And those criteria may satisfy some people. But if we broaden the field and look at these concepts, magic, science, and religion, across history and across geography, we see that any criteria we posit are inevitably violated in at least some contexts. So far, people have not been able to come up with criteria which are always true wherever and whenever the situation arises. So let me get back to your question. What is my definition of religion? Well, to me, it's a set of unquestioned beliefs and socially sanctioned practices that provide answers to some of our fundamental questions, like who are we, why are we here, what is the meaning of life, and things like that, by relating our existence to certain transcendental truths. So very briefly, this is what religion is to me, and I'm sure you could apply a lot of this to science and to magic as well.
That is very, very interesting. Very interesting how you're connecting religion to science and magic. I wouldn't expect you to choose those two things to connect it with, but it makes sense when you're talking about it. I want to connect religion to history now. What about religion makes it have such a profound influence on history?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's very true. Religion has a profound influence on history. Why? Because, well, beliefs are very important to people, right? Some may say that, hunger trumps belief, that what is ultimately important is economic welfare. But in fact, history shows otherwise. For example, if you look at fascist Italy during the Second World War, you see that the most fervent supporters of fascism were also those who were most adversely affected by it economically. So it's not always people's pocketbooks. You know, the idea is the economy stupid. That's not always true. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it isn't. And we don't even need to go as far as fascist Italy. Think about the United States today. I mean, can there be a more bizarre paradox than Donald Trump being seen by the working class as their champion? I mean, it's absolutely absurd. But by using nationalism, racism, and of course, religion, he has managed to win over the most hardcore working class states in the country, like, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio. Sure, one can speak of globalization, of the working class being left behind, and of Trump capitalizing on all of that. Yeah, I mean, that is certainly true. But all that does not change the fact that you have an amoral, money-grubbing billionaire being swept into office by blue-collar voters whose economic interests could not possibly be further from his own priorities. So, okay, now, why specifically religion? Well, You must remember that for most of history, religion has constituted the only widely available system of beliefs. Ideologies like nationalism, like communism, those are modern, right? Before the 19th century, religion was it. People defined themselves as members of a certain religion. They define others as either fellow members of that religion or as non-members of that religion. Education was primarily religious, and therefore people's understanding of life, of the world, of events was shaped primarily by religion. So, it's little wonder that religion has played a leading role in shaping history. It has been the lens, and usually the only lens, through which people have seen the world.
It's very interesting that you brought up the dynamic of Trump and blue-collar workers because it is such opposites. They should not go together in any sense of the world, in any sense of the word, but I guess religion has such a powerful effect on people that, things like that can potentially come up. I want to break down religion a little bit. How are monotheistic religions different from polytheistic religions, besides the fact that monotheistic religions believe in one God and polytheistic religions believe in many gods?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that is the main difference, but it isn't only the number of gods. It's also the nature of the divinity, the way in which it is or they are worshipped, and things of that nature. For one thing, monotheism, or monotheisms, I should say, because there isn't only one, they posit to different degrees a very abstract God. Now, Christianity is perhaps at one extreme in that the Trinity makes God partly quite concrete, right, in the person of the Christ. And Islam is at the other extreme, in that God is totally abstract, unlike anything else, impossible for humans to comprehend or visualize, except through his acts, through what he has created. Although people always speak of the Judeo-Christian tradition, in fact, Judaism and Islam are much closer to each other than Christianity is to either. And the abstractness of God is one of the many things they have in common. On the other hand, polytheism tends to be fairly concrete. The deities are often representable in concrete terms. And idolatry, of course, is the extreme version of polytheism in that respect. In
Well,
monothe Sorry, go ahead.
sorry, no, you go.
Okay, so I mean, in monotheism, all divine attributes are concentrated in a single God. He is all-knowing, he is all-powerful. In polytheism, different gods have different functions. They are in charge of different things. They are even sometimes involved in squabbles, in rivalries, and fights with each other. And as a result, worship practices are different, because while in monotheism, one worships and prays to a single God, in polytheism, one may worship different gods in different circumstances, pray to different gods for different reasons, asking for different things from them. So the absoluteness and unicity of the monotheistic system of laws and morality becomes multiple and contingent in polytheism. So ultimately, I think monotheism requires a much more abstract way of thinking than of divinity than does polytheism.
Well, while we're on the topic of comparing religions, in your opinion, do you think that some religions are better than others?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's possible to answer this question in general, but of course you did say in your opinion, so you aren't asking for a general reply. Certainly, believers of different religions will tend to think of their own religion as superior to all the others, because if it was not, then they would have converted to, whichever religion they thought was superior. So I think perhaps a slightly better question would be, what do different religions offer to their believers that they consider better than others? And I'll tell you a funny story. You may know that Russians were pagans before Prince Vladimir the Great of Kievan Rus converted to Eastern Orthodox Christianity in the year 988. And he ordered the mass baptism of his people, marking the official Christianization of the state. Now, there's a funny story about that, and I don't know whether it's true or just a myth, but it is said that before he adopted Eastern Orthodox Christianity, he had representatives of various religions give him presentations. There was no PowerPoint at the time. I don't know how they presented them, but he gave them presentations of their own faiths so that he would be able to choose the best one among them. And supposedly, he found Islam particularly compelling and was leaning towards adopting it until he was told that Islam does not permit the consumption of alcohol. At which time he said, "My people will never accept such a religion," and chose Christianity instead. Now, true or apocryphal, I don't know. But here's a case where someone supposedly tried to choose the best religion, but he had to factor in his people's way of life, and clearly he believed that they wouldn't give up alcohol. Imagine how different the world would have been today if he had chosen Islam, if the whole of Russia was Muslim. So there are certain aspects of my own religion that I would consider better than others. But I don't want to get into details. I don't want to offend anybody, but certainly the abstractness of God is one of them, is something that draws me particularly.
Why are you drawn by the abstractness of God?
I don't think I can give you a rational explanation. I think it's maybe the way I was brought up or the way I have conceptualized the world. But the idea of, a man sitting on top of the clouds with a big white beard, that doesn't draw me. I mean, the idea of an all-powerful abstractness that governs over the universe, to me is much more credible. But again, I mean, I have respect for others. It's just I'm only talking about myself.
Yeah, that makes sense. That seems like a very rational explanation to me, at least. Your research focuses on the Islamic world, particularly the Ottoman Empire. So, how has Islam influenced law in the Ottoman Empire?
Good question. The Ottoman Empire was a theocracy, as you know. So until the 19th century, it was governed largely by religious law as well as custom. Now, being a multi-confessional empire, the population comprised not only Muslims, but also many Christians of different denominations, as well as Jews and others. And to a degree that is still being debated, this has not been resolved. These different religious communities had some amount of legal autonomy. This autonomy was not absolute by any means, but it did exist, so that individual communities often took care of their own internal affairs. So if you were Greek Orthodox or Gregorian Armenian or Jewish, your legal issues would be often dealt with, in part at least, within your own community. Still, though, I mean, given that, still, Islam was, of course, the ruling religion and the state's main source of legitimacy. After the conquest of Egypt in 1517, the Ottoman Sultan ruling at the time, who was Selim I, supposedly, according to official history, took over the title of caliph from the last Abbasid caliph, whose name was Al-Mutawakkil III, who was under Mamluk protection in Egypt. So, for the next 400 odd years, the ruler of the Ottoman Empire was also the caliph, the spiritual leader of Sunni Islam, Sunni, of course, not Shi'i. But that doesn't mean that he had absolute authority over religion. He wasn't like the Catholic Pope, for example. There was a network of religious courts, and the top religious judge, called the Sheikhul Islam, would be asked by the Sultan to give his religious seal of approval for major political decisions, like going to war, for example. So, in a way, this constituted a limited system of checks and balances, in that the Sultan's authority was circumscribed by religious law.
As a follow-up question, it seems like in the Ottoman Empire, there was a large degree of religious autonomy based on localities, but of course, religion as you said, seem to have a very big influence on law in the Ottoman Empire as well. Do you think the Ottoman Empire was unique in how much autonomy it gave to people of other religions residing in their empire at the
It
time?
seems so. Yeah, I mean, again, as I said, there was until recently there was a belief that after the conquest of Constantinople in 1453, the Sultan met with the Greek Orthodox Patriarch and basically told him that he would have a full autonomy within his own community, and that was then extended to the Armenians and the Jews as well. Over the last few years, people have taken strong issue with this idea that, you know, this was a well-formulated system that was initiated in 1453. But what we do know is that there was, to some degree, to a large degree, limited religious autonomy, in the sense that if you had a problem, let's say you're Jewish and you have a problem, a business problem with one of your customers who is also Jewish, then you would go to a Jewish court. You wouldn't necessarily go to a Muslim court to fix the problem. However, what we know from research, and people have published very nice articles about this, is that because Islam was the official religion, and therefore Islamic courts were a higher authority than the courts of your own community. If you were, let's say, a Jewish Ottoman, and you had a beef with a Jewish Ottoman who was more powerful than you, let's say he was rich or he had good connections or whatever, often what you would do is you would go to a Muslim court, because he would have no influence at that in that Muslim court. So in search of a better chance for themselves, of a more just, less partial court, people, Jews or Christians, would sometimes go to Muslim courts. And of course, if your beef was with a Muslim, then you would go to a Muslim court anyway. But if it was a strictly internal issue, largely until the 19th century, people, communities took care of those issues themselves.
Moving away from the topic of law, how has Islam influenced people's values in the Ottoman Empire?
It's difficult to speak of Islam in the singular when the subject is an entire population. Some scholars like to distinguish between official or orthodox Islam, in other words, Islam as embodied in the scriptures and taught by religious scholars, and everyday lived Islam, in other words, Islam as practiced by ordinary people. This binary classification is to some degree open to criticism. People have criticized it, but there is no doubt that it harbors some essential truths. So things like magic, let's say amulets and talismans, veneration of saints, or visits to shrines and mausolea, these are not part of theoretical or scriptural Islam, but they are very, very widely practiced in many Muslim countries. On the other hand, there are many things that are prohibited by Islam, such as drinking alcohol or charging or collecting interest on loans, that are widely practiced by individuals who still nevertheless consider themselves Muslims. So societies are never exact mirror images of their religions or belief systems. People tend to be a bit flexible. And this is also true of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, there was certainly an Islamic foundation to people's values, no doubt, but not every individual understood those values in exactly the same terms. And that's why it's perhaps more apt, and I like that, to speak of Islamicate culture rather than Islamic culture. This term was coined by the American historian Marshall Hodgson to describe the cultural, artistic, social aspects historically associated with Muslim societies, whether or not they are explicitly religious in nature. It's a common misconception of traditional Western scholarship that Muslim societies can be identified one to one with Islamic religious texts, as if, for example, everything that a Christian does is in perfect agreement with the Bible. It isn't, right? So everything that a Muslim does is not in perfect agreement with the Quran either. There are many aspects of everyday life where we make compromises or even ignore religious principles altogether. And none of that is static. There were times when people followed religion more strictly and times when society was more permissive. Still, I would point to a few things, certain things, like, let's say, taking care of stray animals, for example, or the popularity of abstract art like calligraphy and geometric ornamentation as reflections of Islam in everyday life, particularly in the Ottoman Empire.
So, what you're saying, and it makes total sense, is that Islam was very, very, very complicated. And when applying it to the Ottoman Empire, there's no single answer to how to talk about it. With that said, I want to know how you think Islam has changed in the Ottoman world. Because I know the Ottoman Empire was around for centuries, and it spanned multiple continents. So I want to know, how was Islam viewed at the beginning of the Ottoman Empire, and how was it seen towards the end of the Ottoman Empire?
Good question. This is a good question too. The French philosopher Voltaire famously said, "If God did not exist, it would have been necessary to invent him." And he didn't mean that God does not exist. What he meant was that, independently of any religious truth, the idea of God has an important and indeed a necessary social function. I mean, that's what he was saying. So even if there wasn't a God, society would have had to invent a God in order to fulfill that function. Now, one can think of a corollary to that statement, which is that societies invent God and construct religions according to their needs, or interpret religions, if you want, if you prefer. Again, this doesn't mean that there is no truth to religion. You know that I have faith, but what I mean is that specific religions answer specific needs that specific societies have at specific times, and they get interpreted, and some things get stressed, and other things get relaxed according to those needs. But of course, societies change, their needs change, and so it's natural that religion and the way religion is viewed and experienced should also change over time. Let me give you an example. Think of the concept of the supernatural. It's a modern concept, right? Because before the Enlightenment, before the scientific revolution, there was no distinction between natural and supernatural. I mean, if your crop failed, it was because your neighbor put a curse on you. You got sick, it was because demons had taken possession of your body. Your child died, God was punishing you for your sins. All these things were the purview of religion, of the supernatural. So no, one would go to faith healers, to exorcists, make offerings to God or to gods, and so forth. Today we distinguish between natural and supernatural. We have something called the germ theory of disease. We know a bit about viruses, about genetics, about immunology. And so today, for most people, with notable exceptions like, the Christian Science, for example, religion no longer applies to things like medicine. So what I'm trying to say is that, independently of the truth of a religion, our perception of religion, of the divinity, change in response to socioeconomic and sociohistorical circumstances and conditions.
There's this theory in the field of sociology called structural functionalism. And what you're saying reminds me of structural functionalism, that every part of a society is there because it's needed in some way. And I think it's interesting how you connected religion to that theory. But getting away from how religion. Oh, sorry, you go.
Yeah, let me just say one little thing, because my wife is a sociologist, and if she hears that I'm a functionalist, she'll probably divorce me. Let me just make a little correction and say this, that I think that things are shaped according to functions, but then they do not arise spontaneously to satisfy functions. It's just that there is religion, and the way we interpret it follows what use we make of it. But let me not let let's not make me a function a hardcore functionalist.
Okay, I don't want you to get divorced, so I'll just say it here. He is not a functionalist, don't worry. Getting
Thank
away
you.
from how the perception of religion has changed over time, I want to connect religion to the present moment. You are from Turkey. How is religion utilized by the Turkish government as a tool for authoritarianism?
Okay, well, I'll say something now which would get me in serious trouble if I was currently living in Turkey. Fortunately, I'm not. Which is that the current Turkish government is a kleptocracy. It's essentially an organized crime syndicate, it's in charge of all sorts of crimes, which I can detail for you if you want, but it's not really our subject right now. But despite all the crimes that it commits, or maybe because of them, it like all governments, it needs legitimacy in order to govern. So, as a political scientist, you know better than I do that governments do not rule by brute force alone, right? They need popular consent in some form or other. Religion is one of the sources of legitimation that governments have historically used for this purpose. Now, Samuel Johnson famously said, as patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel, but I think so is religion. Again, Donald Trump's Bible thumping is a good example. And personally, I will never understand how so many good Christian people have fallen for that amoral serial adulterer's religious routine. The situation is similar in Turkey. Sincere, faithful Muslims will tell you that President Erdogan is a good Muslim, that he prays and fasts and recites the Quran, that he has reversed the damage done to the country by his predecessor's aggressive secularism. And there is some truth to that, without any doubt. But at what cost? Lawlessness has reached enormous proportions in Turkey, and it starts at the very top, from rampant bribery to drug trafficking. The government has a hand in virtually every illegal activity that goes on. Now, from your own research that actually we discussed before, that technology and especially the digital media have been used extensively to push the government's agenda. That is almost always done with a religious veneer, whether they are denouncing the West's, Christian biases and anti-Islam prejudices, or the local cultural elite's secularism. It's always in the service of some political or economic interest. The simple fact is that inflation is in the upper two digits, almost 83% annualized, according to official figures right now, 83%. The national currency has lost more than 80% of its value against the US dollar over the last 5 years. Rents have skyrocketed. And for the first time in more than a century, hunger is a real problem for many citizens in Turkey. The government has alienated every single international ally by failing to pursue a consistent foreign policy. And basically, Turkey is bankrupt and fast becoming a failed state. So all that the government has to offer today is a semblance of religious piety. They have nothing else left. So religion is essentially the currency of the government.
Okay, and you said very early on in the episode that history is important because, well, future events might not look exactly the same as historical events. There are things we can learn from historical events. And what you're saying now is that the Turkish government doesn't really have anything to offer. So it's turning towards religion as a way to keep popular support, which it needs for Erdogan, for example, to stay in power. And I can't help but thinking about the US when you're talking about that, because obviously the Trump administration wants
to retain popular support. And as the, tariffs inevitably make the economy worse, as the Epstein scandal grows, blah blah blah, I can name a million things. I'm wondering if the Trump administration is even going to take a harder turn towards Christian nationalism and these conservative values, because it doesn't have other things to offer its people. And I think a way to answer that is to look at history. Do you think, or have you seen, that other governments besides Turkey have gone down the path that Turkey's going down right now, if that makes sense, using religion as a crutch because they don't have that much else to offer its people?
Yes, definitely. I mean, that's very, very true. There's one aspect that the United States has that Turkey doesn't have, and that's the issue of race, because Turkey is more or less racially homogeneous. But other than that, as far as religion is concerned, Turkey, as well as other countries like Hungary, like Belarus, like India, under Modi, they have used religion as a crutch or as a tool to further their agendas. In fact, if you compare the Christian nationalist in the US and the religious right in Turkey, it's amazing. It's as if they're using the same playbook. It's no accident that many causes deployed by the Turkish government are identical to causes adopted by the Christian right in this country, because many of them were actually imported into Turkey from here. Let me give you examples, okay? Abortion. When I was young, this was not an issue. People didn't talk about it in Turkey. Now people are talking about it, and the religious right is, of course, dead set against it. LGBTQ. Well, I'm not saying that the people had absolute freedom when I was young, but this was not something that we discussed on a daily basis. Now it is being talked about. Or evolution, that's another example. When I was growing up, we were taught evolution in elementary school as fact. Now people are saying, well, it's only a theory, and maybe it's not true, which is exactly what the Christian right is saying here. So in many ways, these issues, there is a certain international religious right discourse, which countries are helping themselves to. And it doesn't matter where it is invented. I'm not saying all these things were invented here necessarily, but they are shared by these various governments. And the sad fact is that, brute force does not come equipped with intellectual sophistication usually, right? I mean, the political tools used by authoritarian regimes are fairly basic and largely similar to each other. And so, they all use roughly the same tools to advance their own agendas.
Wow, that's very, very interesting and enlightening about how there are so many similarities between the religious right in other countries and the religious right in this country. For my final question, I'm actually going to start something called the audience question. So basically, I have a viewer give me a question. And for this week's rendition of it, a viewer wants to know, how have modern religions absorbed parts of older, smaller religions?
Yeah, that's a very, very reasonable, very good question. And the question basically, correctly assumes that there aren't absolute discontinuities in human thinking. So even revolutions, if you think of the French or the Soviet revolutions, they were not absolutely discontinuous. There were lots of features which exhibited continuity before and after the revolution. And the same applies to religions. The main issue is how to interpret those existing continuities. So let's take Islam, since we're talking about Islam today. There are several books. Many were written in the 19th, late 19th and early 20th centuries, that bear titles like What Did Muhammad Take from Judaism? And those kinds of titles. A lot of them are in German, those books. And such a title is meaningful if you believe that Muhammad invented a new religion. And in the process of doing so, drew inspiration from the various religions that were around him, especially Judaism. And the authors of those books were, of course, non-Muslims, and they so assumed. If, on the other hand, you're a Muslim and you believe that Muhammad was the true messenger of God and simply transmitted the one true religion that was revealed to him, then your explanation of these continuities will be different, right? Then you will say, well, they're not plagiarized from other religions. They just come from the same source. You know, there is one God. The God of Judaism, of Christianity, and of Islam is the same God. And so it's hardly surprising that there should be similarities between earlier monotheistic religions and later monotheistic religions. So, what sorts of similarities are we talking about? Well, there are some obvious ones between, let's say, Judaism and Islam, such as the circumcision of boys, the prohibition of eating pork, you know, those sorts of things. But there are others that are not so obvious. And one subject I have worked on very extensively over the last decade or so is the occult in Islam. And when you look at occult practices in Islam, you see that they have deep roots not only in Judaism, but in ancient Greece, in ancient Egypt, in Mesopotamia, and even in India. So I want to give you a striking example that I have written about, and that is the Prophet Muhammad is related to have said, "The dream of a believer is 1/46th of prophecy." This is a quote from the Prophet. Now, this was in response to a question regarding whether or not revelations would end after the Prophet had died. People have interpreted this strange number, why 46, in various ways. But here's a particularly interesting fact. It is said in the Talmud that a dream is 1/60th of prophecy. Now, isn't this amazing? I mean, one is 46, the other is 60. Okay, the numbers are different, but it's verbatim the same statement, other than the number. There are many, many other examples that blend old religions into new religions. And this is basically called syncretism, and can be seen, for example, in Africa, after contact with the Portuguese in the late 15th century. The elite in the Congo converted to Catholicism, but they did so in part by incorporating Christian saints and rituals into their previously existing religions, rather than simply replacing them outright. In West Africa, Islam was similarly blended with local customs such as healers, veneration of saints, talismans, and those sorts of things. In the New World, notably the Caribbean and South America, there are creolized local religions blending Christianity with African elements brought over through the Atlantic slave trade, for example, Santeria in Cuba. So this is not surprising if you ask me, because you know people do adopt new ideas, but giving up old ideas is much harder. And so instead of giving up our old ideas, we modify them and fold them into our new ideas. And I think that's just the way we operate.
All right. And before we run out of time, I want to do this week's rendition of the Google the Professor quiz, where I search the professor on Google and ask them some questions. So the first question I have for you is, in what year was your book, The Erotic Margin, published?
1999.
Correct. And what is that book about?
Okay, that book is about how sexuality has been used by culture over history to construct spatial difference. So, for example, you know, think about what is the cliche about let's say Italian men, right? Now, you know, there is this cliche, right? So that in a way builds Italy as a certain kind of place. Or what is the cliche about Turkish harems? You know, that builds Turk constructs Turkey in a certain way. So that's what I looked at in the book. I tried to see how sexuality has been instrumentalized in the process of constructing geographical difference.
Wow, that sounds very interesting. I might have to read it.
I would like that.
You also edited it. You also edited a book called What and Architecture in the Muslim World.
What was the oh, calligraphy, of course. Yeah, calligraphy.
Calligraphy. And I know you've done a lot of work on calligraphy. What do you like about calligraphy so much?
There are several things. One of them is, and this is, confession time. I am colorblind, actually, literally colorblind. Fortunately, I don't have red green color blindness, so I can drive, but I do have problems with different kinds of colors. And so I have never been able to get a lot out of colors. Since you are a Northeasterner as well, we get fall foliage, right? And everybody comes to New England from all over the country to watch fall foliage, and they all go ooh and ah when they see the trees, take all these weird colors. And I look and I say, oh, okay, big deal, because I really do not see those colors. And the fact that calligraphy is basically graphic. It's black and white. I also like op art, for example. So I like graphic design a lot, because I can appreciate it better than a multicolored work of art. So that is one reason. And another reason is just that calligraphy is not just, a piece of scribbles written on a piece of paper. There is a huge world of culture behind it. There is the whole system of, how calligraphy is taught. There are the diplomas. There are all the tools of calligraphy. There's a whole world behind it. And that world has fascinated me for many, many years. So, and that's what I've studied. Not so much biographies as art of artists, but rather, what does calligraphy mean? Why do Muslims like calligraphy? What does it say to them? That sort of thing.
Wow, that seems like a pretty cool topic. Last question for you, and you are doing great on this quiz, by the way. You have taught at many different schools, and which one is your favorite? And I know you have taught at UMass, and I went to UMass, but you don't have to say UMass unless you want it.
Well, I was at UMass only for one semester, and I have to say that I enjoyed it very, very much. But it would be unfair to some of the others where I spend longer time if I chose UMass. But I can say that I have no, I have nothing negative to say about my teaching at UMass,
Okay.
except that one day when I was driving over, and I never told you guys this, I was almost killed when a 18-wheeler swerved into me. Fortunately, my reflexes were fast enough, and I managed to get away from it. But other than the drive over and the crazy 18-wheelers, everything else teaching at UMass was wonderful. I think what I liked best was teaching at Shahir University. And the reason for that is that, well, first of all, I was back in Turkey after so many years, and it was interesting to live there as a Turk rather than as a tourist. I used to go there and spend money as a tourist and take cabs everywhere. And, it wasn't like living like a local person. And after so many years, I was living like a Turk, and I enjoyed it very much. And also, Şehir University had lots of scholarships, so that we got lots of very smart but poor students, who were really driven, who were very highly motivated, and who were very, very good. As I know you're not intending to go into an academic career yet at this point, but without any doubt, the best thing about an academic career is the students. If the students are smart, then all the work that you do is worthwhile. And I can tell you that one of the universities where I spent one semester, and I shall not name it, the students were so lazy that when I gave them a take home, they couldn't be bothered with cheating. They got, I think the class average was 45, even though they could have gone home and copied the books. And in that case, it was a horrible semester because the students just didn't give a damn. And at UMass, the students were very dedicated, most of them, certainly you were, and that makes everything worthwhile, because one thing that you may or may not know is that professors work very hard before they come to class. It's not like we recite everything that we already know. We have to study, and it makes the whole thing worthwhile when you guys respond. So I very much enjoyed UMass, but Shahir, I think, was my favorite.
Okay. I'll let that one slide. But Irvin, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast. It was a pleasure having you here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Have
All
a
right.
great one.
Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna stop the recording.